Welcome to Sleepy Time Travels. This week, we wander back a century to listen to a poet from India who has come to America to attempt to relate some of the wisdom of his culture to a Western crowd quite hungry for the products of his calm and peaceful mind. This selection from Rabindranath Tagore's Personality Lectures Delivered in America is titled My School and details the frustration he had with India's public school system and his desire to provide something better for his son. Every teacher alive today and every parent could gain great understanding from his experience recreating a school experience from an earlier age that he hoped guided children to become beautiful human beings. My name is Russell Stamets. I read old books. Some people like to fall asleep while I do. The public domain books that I choose to dust off, narrate, and produce as audiobooks range from the occult to Eastern philosophy to folktales. If you'd like to hear more of those I showcase on the podcast, or check out the rest of my catalog, search Russell Stamets on Audible or iTunes. I'll include links to the audiobooks and the Kindle and print editions in the episode description. Fame, glory, and money are all good, so if you like my efforts in this space, please follow, subscribe, rate 5 stars, or, of course, buy the book. That's enough panhandling for now. It's time to hear about Tagore and his school. Relax, breathe deep, and listen. I started a school in Bengal when I was nearing 40. Certainly, this was never expected of me, who had spent the greater portion of my life in writing, chiefly verses. Therefore, people naturally thought that, as a school, it might be one of the best of its kind. But it was sure to be something outrageously new, being the product of daring inexperience. This is one of the reasons why I am often asked what is the idea upon which my school is based. The question is a very embarrassing one for me, because to satisfy the expectation of my questioners, I cannot afford to be commonplace in my answer. However, I shall resist the temptation to be original and shall be content with being merely truthful. In the first place, I must confess it is difficult for me to say what is the idea which underlies my institution. For the idea is not like a fixed foundation upon which a building is erected. It is more like a seed which cannot be separated and pointed out directly. It begins to grow into a plant. And I know what it was to which this school owes its origin. It was not any new theory of education, but the memory of my school days. That those days were unhappy ones for me, I cannot altogether ascribe to my peculiar temperament or to any special demerit of the schools to which I was sent. It may be that if I had been a little less sensitive, I could gradually have accommodated myself to the pressure and survived long enough to earn my university degrees. But all the same, schools are schools, though some are better and some worse, according to their own standard. The provision has been made for infants to be fed upon their mother's milk. They find their food and their mother at the same time. It is complete nourishment for them, body and soul. It is their first introduction to the great truth that man's true relationship with the world is that of personal love, and not that of the mechanical law of causation. The introduction and the conclusion of a book have a similarity of features. In both places, the complete aspect of truth is given. Only in the introduction, it is simple because undeveloped. And in the conclusion, it becomes simple again because perfectly developed. Truth has the middle course of its career, where it grows complex, where it hurts itself against obstacles, breaks itself into pieces to find itself back in a fuller unity of realization. Similarly, Man's introduction to this world is his introduction to his final truth in a simple form. He is born into a world which to him is intensely living, where he as an individual occupies the full attention of his surroundings. Then he grows up to doubt this deeply personal aspect of reality. He loses himself in the complexity of things, separates himself from his surroundings, often in a spirit of antagonism. But this shattering of the unity of truth, this uncompromising civil war between his personality and his outer world, can never find its meaning in interminable discord. Thereupon, to find the true conclusion of his life, he has to come back through this digression of doubt to the simplicity of perfect truth, to his union with all in an infinite bond of love. Therefore, our childhood should be given its full measure of life's draught, for which it has an endless thirst. The young mind should be saturated with the idea that it has been born in a human world which is in harmony with the world around it. And this is what our regular type of school ignores with an air of superior wisdom, severe and disdainful. It forcibly snatches away children from a world full of the mystery of God's own handiwork, full of the suggestiveness of personality. It is a mere method of discipline which refuses to take into account the individual. It is a manufactory specially designed for grinding out uniform results. It follows an imaginary straight line of the average in digging its channel of education. But life's line is not the straight line, for it is fond of playing the seesaw with the line of the average, bringing upon its head the rebuke of the school. For according to the school, life is perfect when it allows itself to be treated as dead, to be cut into symmetrical conveniences. And this was the cause of my suffering when I was sent to school. For all of a sudden, I found my world vanishing from around me, giving place to wooden benches and straight walls staring at me with the blank stare of the blind. I was not a creation of the schoolmaster. The government board of education was not consulted when I took birth in the world. But was that any reason why they should wreak their vengeance upon me for this oversight of my Creator? But the legend is that eating of the fruit of knowledge is not consonant with dwelling in paradise. Therefore, men's children have to be banished from their paradise into a realm of death, dominated by the decency of a tailoring department. So my mind had to accept the tight-fitting encasement of the school which, being like the shoes of a Mandarin woman, pinched and bruised my nature on all sides and at every movement. I was fortunate enough in extricating myself before insensibility set in. Though I did not have to serve the full penal term which men of my position have to undergo to find their entrance into cultured society, I am glad that I did not altogether escape from its molestation, for it has given me knowledge of the wrong from which the children of men suffer. The cause of it is this, that man's intention is going against God's intention as to how children should grow into knowledge. How we should conduct our business is our own affair, and therefore in our offices we are free to create in the measure of our special purposes. But such office arrangement does not suit God's creation. And children are God's own creation. We have come to this world to accept it, not merely to know it. We may become powerful by knowledge, but we attain fullness by sympathy. The highest education is that which does not merely give us information, but makes our life in harmony with all existence. But we find that this education of sympathy is not only systematically ignored in schools, but it is severely repressed. From our very childhood, habits are formed and knowledge is imparted in such a manner that our life is weaned away from nature, and our mind and the world are set in opposition from the beginning of our days. Thus, the greatest of educations for which we came prepared is neglected. And we are made to lose our world, to find a bag full of information instead. We rob the children of this earth to teach him geography, of language to teach him grammar. His hunger is for the epic, but he is supplied with chronicles of facts and dates. He was born in the human world, but is banished into the world of living gramophones to expiate for the original sin of being born in ignorance. Child nature protests against such calamity with all its power of suffering, subdued at last into silence by punishment. We all know children are lovers of the dust. Their whole body and mind thirst for sunlight and air as flowers do. They are never in a mood to refuse the constant invitations to establish direct communication which comes to their senses from the universe. But unfortunately for children, their parents, in the pursuit of their profession, in conformity to their social traditions, live in their own peculiar world of habits. Much of this cannot be helped, for men have to specialize, driven by circumstances and by need of social uniformity. But our childhood is the period when we have or ought to have more freedom. Freedom from the necessity of specialization into the narrow bounds of social and professional conventionalism. I well remember the surprise and annoyance of an experienced headmaster, reputed to be a successful disciplinarian, when he saw one of the boys of my school climbing a tree and choosing a fork of the branches for settling down to his studies. I had to say to him, in explanation, that childhood is the only period of life when a civilized man can exercise his choice between the branches of a tree and his drawing-room chair. And should I deprive this boy of that privilege because I, as a grown-up man, am barred from it? What is surprising is to notice the same headmaster's approbation of the boys studying botany. He believes in an impersonal knowledge of the tree, because that is science, but not in a personal experience of it. This growth of experience leads to forming instinct, which is the result of nature's own method of instruction. The boys of my school have acquired instinctive knowledge of the physiognomy of the tree. By the least touch, they know where they can find a foothold upon an apparently inhospitable trunk. They know how far they can take liberty with the branches, how to distribute their body's weight so as to make themselves least burdensome to branchlets. My boys are able to make the best possible use of the tree in the matter of gathering fruits, taking rest, and hiding from undesirable pursuers. I myself was brought up in a cultured home in a town, and as far as my personal behavior goes, I have been obliged to act all through my life as if I were born in a world where there are no trees. Therefore, I consider it as a part of education for my boys to let them fully realize that they are in a scheme of existence where trees are a substantial fact, not merely as generating chlorophyll and taking carbon from the air, but as living trees. Naturally, the soles of our feet are so made that they become the best instruments for us to stand upon the earth and to walk with. From the day we commenced to wear shoes, we minimized the purpose of our feet. With the lessening of their responsibility, they have lost their dignity, and now they lend themselves to be pampered with socks, slippers, and shoes of all prices and shapes and misproportions. For us, it amounts to a grievance against God for not giving us hooves instead of beautifully sensitive soles. I am not for banishing footgear altogether from men's use, but I have no hesitation in asserting that the soles of children's feet should not be deprived of their education, provided for them by nature, free of cost. Of all the limbs we have, they are the best adapted for intimately knowing the earth by their touch. For the earth has her subtle modulations of contour, which she only offers for the kiss of her true lovers, the feet. I, from all naked contact with the dust. When I try to emulate my boys in walking barefoot, I painfully realize what thickness of ignorance about the earth I carry under my feet. I invariably choose the thorns to tread upon in such a manner as to make the thorns exult. My feet have not the instinct to follow the lines of least resistance, for even the flattest of earth's surfaces has its dimples of diminutive hills and dales, only discernible by educated feet. I have often wondered at the unreasonable zigzag of footpaths across perfectly plain fields. It becomes all the more perplexing when you consider that a footpath is not made by the caprice of one individual. Unless most of the walkers possessed exactly the same eccentricity, such obviously inconvenient passages could not have been made. But the real cause lies in the subtle suggestions coming from the earth, to which our feet unconsciously respond. Those for whom such communications have not been cut off can adjust the muscles of their feet with great rapidity at the least indication. Therefore, they can save themselves from the intrusion of thorns, even while treading upon them, and walk barefooted on a gravelly path without the least discomfort. I know that in the practical world, shoes will be worn, roads will be metalled, cars will be used. But during their period of education, should children not be given to know that the world is not all drawing room, that there is such a thing as nature to which their limbs are made beautifully to respond? There are men who think that by the simplicity of living, introduced in my school, I preach the idealization of poverty which prevailed in the medieval age. The full discussion of this subject is outside the scope of my paper, but seen from the point of view of education, should we not admit that poverty is the school in which man had his first lessons and his best training? Even a millionaire's son has to be born helplessly poor and to begin his lesson of life from the beginning. He has to learn to walk like the poorest of children, though he has means to afford to be without the appendage of legs. Poverty brings us into complete touch with life and the world, for living richly is living mostly by proxy, and thus living in a world of lesser reality. This may be good for one's pleasure and pride, but not for one's education. Wealth is a golden cage, in which the children of the rich are bred into artificial deadening of their powers. Therefore, in my school, much to the disgust of the people of expensive habits, I had to provide for this great teacher, this barrenness of furniture and materials, not because it is poverty, but because it leads to personal experience of the world. What I propose is that men should have some limited period of their life specially reserved for the life of the primitive man. Civilized busybodies have not been allowed to tamper with the unborn child. In the mother's womb, it has leisure to finish its first stage of the vegetative life. But directly it is born, with all its instincts ready for the next stage, which is the natural life, it is at once pounced upon by the society of cultivated habits, to be snatched away from the open arms of earth, water, and sky, from the sunlight and air. At first it struggles and bitterly cries, and then it gradually forgets that it had for its inheritance God's creation. Then it shuts its windows, pulls down its curtains, loses itself among meaningless miscellanies, and feels proud of its accumulations at the cost of its world and possibly of his soul. The civilized world of conventions and things comes in the middle career of man's progress. It is neither in the beginning nor in the end. Its enormous complexity and codes of decorum have their uses. But when it takes these to be final, and makes it a rule that no green spot should be left in man's life away from its reign of smoke and noise, of draped and decorated propriety, then children suffer, and in the young men is produced world weariness, while old men, forget to grow old in peace and beauty, merely becoming dilapidated youths, ashamed of their shabbiness of age, full of holes and patchwork. However, it is certain that children did not bargain for this muffled and screened world of decency when they were ready to be born upon this earth. If they had any idea that they were about to open their eyes to the sunlight, only to find themselves in the hands of the education department till they should lose their freshness of mind and keenness of sense, they would think twice before venturing upon their career of humanity. God's arrangements are never insolently special arrangements. They always have the harmony of wholeness and unbroken continuity with all things. Therefore, what tortured me in my school days was the fact that the school had not the completeness of the world. It was a special arrangement for giving lessons. It could only be suitable for grown-up people who were conscious of the special need of such places and therefore ready to accept their teaching at the cost of dissociation from life. But children are in love with life, and it is their first love. All its color and movement attract their eager attention. And are we quite sure of our wisdom in stifling this love? Children are not born ascetics, fit to enter at once into the monastic discipline of acquiring knowledge. At first, they must gather knowledge through their love of life, and then they will renounce their lives to gain knowledge, and then again they will come back to their fuller lives with ripened wisdom. But society has made its own arrangements for manipulating men's minds to fit its special patterns. These arrangements are so closely organized that it is difficult to find gaps through which to bring in nature. There is a serial adjustment of penalties which follows to the end one who ventures to take liberty with some part of the arrangements, even to save his soul. Therefore, it is one thing to realize truth, and another to bring it into practice, where the whole current of the prevailing system goes against you. This is why, when I had to face the problem of my own son's education, I was at a loss to give it a practical solution. The first thing that I did was to take him away from the town surroundings into a village and allow him the freedom of primeval nature as far as it is available in modern days. He had a river, noted for its danger, where he swam and rowed without check from the anxiety of his elders. He spent his time in the fields and on the trackless sandbanks, coming late for his meals without being questioned. He had none of those luxuries that are not only customary, but are held as proper for boys of his circumstance, for which privations, I am sure, he was pitied, and his parents blamed by the people for whom society had blotted out the whole world. But I was certain that luxuries are burdens to boys. They are the burdens of other people's habits, the burdens of the vicarious pride and pleasure which parents enjoy through their children. Yet, being an individual of limited resources, I could do very little for my son in the way of educating him according to my plan. But he had freedom of movement. He had very few of the screens of wealth and respectability between himself and the world of nature. Thus, he had a better opportunity for a real experience of this universe than I ever had. But one thing exercised my mind as more important than anything else. The object of education is to give man the unity of truth. Formerly, when life was simple, all the different elements of man were in complete harmony. But when there came the separation of the intellect from the spiritual and the physical, the school education put entire emphasis on the intellect and the physical side of man. We devote our sole attention to giving children information, not knowing that by this emphasis we are accentuating a break between the intellectual, physical, and the spiritual life. I believe in a spiritual world, not as anything separate from this world, but as its innermost truth. With the breath we draw, we must always feel this truth, that we are living in God. Born in this great world, full of the mystery of the infinite. We cannot accept our existence as a momentary outburst of chance, drifting on the current of matter towards an eternal nowhere. We cannot look upon our lives as dreams of a dreamer who has no awakening in all time. We have a personality to which matter and force are unmeaning unless related to something infinitely personal, whose nature we have discovered, in some measure, in human love, in the greatness of the good, in the martyrdom of heroic souls, in the ineffable beauty of nature, which can never be a mere physical fact, nor anything but an expression of personality. Experience of this spiritual world, whose reality we miss by our incessant habit of ignoring it from childhood, has to be gained by children by fully living in it, and not through the medium of theological instruction. But how this is to be done is a problem difficult of solution in the present age. For nowadays, men have managed so fully to occupy their time that they do not find leisure to know that their activities have only movement, but very little truth, that their soul has not found its world. In India, we still cherish in our memory the tradition of the forest colonies of great teachers. These places were neither schools nor monasteries, in the modern sense of the word. They consisted of homes where, with their families, lived men whose object was to see the world in God and to realize their own life in Him. Though they lived outside society, yet they were to society what the sun is to the planets, the center from which it received its life and light. And here boys grew up in an intimate vision of eternal life before they were thought fit to enter the state of the householder. Thus, in the ancient India, the school was there where was the life itself. There the students were brought up, not in the academic atmosphere of scholarship and learning, or in the maimed life of monastic seclusion, but in the atmosphere of living aspiration. They took the cattle to pasture, collected firewood, gathered fruit, cultivated kindness to all creatures, and grew in their spirit with their own teacher's spiritual growth. This was possible because the primary object of these places was not teaching, but giving shelter to those who lived their life in God. That this traditional relationship of the masters and disciples is not a mere romantic fiction is proved by the relic we still possess of the indigenous system of education, which has preserved its independence for centuries, to be about to succumb at last to the hand of the foreign bureaucratic control. These chatuspathas, which is the Sanskrit name for the university, have not the savor of the school about them. The students live in their master's home like the children of the house, without having to pay for their board and lodging or tuition. The teacher prosecutes his own study, living a life of simplicity, and helping the students in their lessons as a part of his life and not of his profession. This ideal of education through sharing a life of high aspiration with one's master took possession of my mind. The narrowness of our caged-up future and the sordidness of our maimed opportunities urged me all the more towards its realization. Those who in other countries are favored with unlimited expectations of worldly prospects can fix their purposes of education on those objects. The range of their life is varied and wide enough to give them the freedom necessary for development of their powers. But for us to maintain the self-respect which we owe to ourselves and to our Creator, we must make the purpose of our education nothing short of the highest purpose of man, the fullest growth and freedom of soul. It is pitiful to have to scramble for small pittances of fortune. Only let us have access to the life that goes beyond death and rises above all circumstances. Let us find our God. Let us live for that ultimate truth which emancipates us from the bondage of the dust and gives us the wealth, not of things, but of inner light, not of power, but of love. Such emancipation of soul we have witnessed in our country, among men devoid of book learning and living in absolute poverty. In India, we have the inheritance of this treasure of spiritual wisdom. Let the object of our education be to open it out before us, and to give us the power to make the true use of it in our life, and offer it to the rest of the world, when the time comes, as our contribution to its eternal welfare. I had been immersed in literary activities when this thought struck my mind with painful intensity. I suddenly felt like one groaning under the suffocation of nightmare. It was not only my own soul, but the soul of my country, that seemed to be struggling for its breath through me. I felt clearly that what was needed was not any particular material object, not wealth or comfort or power, but our awakening to full consciousness in soul freedom, the freedom of the life in God, where we have no enmity with those who must fight, no competition with those who must make money, where we are beyond all attacks and above all insults. Fortunately for me, I had a place ready to my hand where I could begin my work. My father, in one of his numerous travels, had selected this lonely spot as the one suitable for his life of communion with God. This place, with a permanent endowment, he dedicated to the use of those who seek peace and seclusion for their meditation and prayer. I had about 10 boys with me when I came here, and started my new life with no previous experience whatsoever. All round our ashram is a vast open country, bare up to the line of the horizon, except for sparsely growing stunted date palms and prickly shrubs struggling with anthills. Below the level of the field, there extend numberless mounds and tiny hillocks of red gravel and pebbles of all shapes and colors, intersected by narrow channels of rainwater. Not far away, towards the south, near the village, can be seen through the intervals of a row of palm trees the gleaming surface of steel-blue water, collected in a hollow of the ground. A road used by the village people for their marketing in the town goes meandering through the lonely fields, with its red dust staring in the sun. Travelers coming up this road can see from a distance, on the summit of the undulating ground, the spire of a temple and the top of a building, indicating the Shanti Niketan Ashram, among its amalaki groves and its avenue of stately sal trees. And here the school has been growing up for over 15 years, passing through many changes and often grave crises. Having the evil reputation of a poet, I could with great difficulty win the trust of my countrymen and avoid the suspicion of the bureaucracy. That at last I have been able to accomplish it in some measure is owing to my never expecting it, going on in my own way without waiting for outside sympathy, help, or advice. My resources were extremely small, with the burden of a heavy debt upon them. But this poverty itself gave me the full strength of freedom, making me rely upon truth rather than upon materials. Because the growth of this school was the growth of my life, and not that of mere carrying out of my doctrines, its ideals changed with its maturity, like a ripening fruit that not only grows in its bulk and deepens in its color, but undergoes change in the very quality of its inner pulp. I started with the idea that I had a benevolent object to perform. I worked hard, but the only satisfaction I had came from keeping count of the amount of sacrifice in money, energy, and time, admiring my own untiring goodness. But the result achieved was of small worth. I went on building system after system and then pulling them down. It merely occupied my time. But at the heart, my work remained vacant. I well remember when an old disciple of my father came and said to me, "What I see about me is like a wedding hall where nothing is wanting in preparation, only the bridegroom is absent. The mistake I made was in thinking that my own purpose was the bridegroom. But gradually, my heart found its center. It was not in the work, not in my wish, but in truth. I sat alone on the upper terrace of the Shanti Niketan house and gazed out upon the treetops of the Sal Avenue before me. I withdrew my heart from my own schemes and calculations, from my daily struggles, and held it up in silence before the peace and presence that permeated the sky. And gradually my heart was filled. I began to see the world around me through the eyes of my soul. The trees seemed to me like silent hymns rising from the mute heart of the earth, and the shouts and laughter of the boys mingling in the evening sky came before me like trees of living sounds rising up from the depth of human life. I found my message in the sunlight that touched my inner mind and felt a fullness in the sky that spoke to me in the word of our ancient Rishi. Who could ever move and strive and live in this world if the sky were not filled with love? Thus, when I turned back from the struggle to achieve results, from the ambition of doing benefit to others, and came to my own innermost need, when I felt that living one's own life in truth is living the life of all the world, then the unquiet atmosphere of the outward struggle cleared up, and the power of spontaneous creation found its way through the center of all things. Even now, whatever is superficial and futile in the workings of our institution is owing to distrust of the spirit lurking in our mind, to the ineradicable consciousness of our self-importance, to the habit of looking for the cause of our failures outside us, and the endeavor to repair all looseness in our work by tightening the screws of organization. From my experience, I know that where the eagerness to teach others is too strong, especially in the matter of spiritual life, the result becomes meager and mixed with untruth. All the hypocrisy and self-delusion in our religious convictions and practices are the outcome of the goadings of overzealous activities of mentorship. In our spiritual attainment, gaining and giving are the same thing. As in a lamp, to light itself is the same as to impart light to others. When a man makes it his profession to preach God to others, then he will raise the dust more than give direction to truth. Teaching of religion can never be imparted in the form of lessons. It is there where there is religion in living. Therefore, the idea of the forest colony of the seekers of God as the true school of spiritual life holds good even in this age. Religion is not a fractional thing that can be doled out in fixed weekly or daily measures, as one among various subjects in the school syllabus. It is the truth of our complete being, the consciousness of our personal relationship with the infinite. It is the true center of gravity of our life. This we can attain during our childhood by daily living in a place where the truth of the spiritual world is not obscured by a crowd of necessities assuming artificial importance, where life is simple, surrounded by fullness of leisure, by ample space and pure air, and profound peace of nature, and where men live with a perfect faith in the eternal life before them. But the question will be asked whether I have attained my ideal in this institution. My answer is that the attainment of all our deepest ideals is difficult to measure by outward standards. Its working is not immediately perceptible by results. We have fully admitted the inequalities and varieties of human life in our ashram. We never try to gain some kind of outward uniformity by weeding out the differences of nature and training of our members. Some of us belong to the Brahma Samaj sect, and some to other sects of Hinduism. And some of us are Christians. Because we do not deal with creeds and dogmas of sectarianism, therefore this heterogeneity of our religious beliefs does not present us with any difficulty whatever. This also I know, that the feeling of respect for the ideal of this place and the life lived here greatly varies in depth and earnestness among those who have gathered in the ashram. I know that our inspiration for a higher life has not risen far above our greed for worldly goods and reputation. Yet I am perfectly certain, and proofs of it are numerous, that the ideal of the ashram is sinking deeper and deeper into our nature every day. The tuning of our life's strings into purer spiritual notes is going on without our being aware of it. Whatever might be our original motive in coming here, the call sounds without ceasing through all our clamor of discords. The call of Shantam, Shivam, Advaitam, the all peace, the all good, and the one. The sky here seems penetrated with the voice of the infinite, making the peace of its daybreak and stillness of its night profound with meaning, and sending through the white crowds of Shiuli flowers in the autumn and Malati in the summer the message of self-dedication in the perfect beauty of worship. It will be difficult for others than Indians to realize all the associations that are grouped round the word ashram, the forest sanctuary, for it blossomed in India like its own lotus, under a sky generous in its sunlight and starry splendor. India's climate has brought to us the invitation of the open air. The language of her mighty rivers is solemn in their chants. The limitless expanse of her plains encircles our homes with the silence of the world beyond. Where the sun rises from the marge of the green earth, like an offering of the unseen to the altar of the unknown. And it goes down to the west at the end of the day like a gorgeous ceremony of nature's salutation to the eternal. In India, the shades of the trees are hospitable. The dust of the earth stretches its brown arms to us. The air with its embraces clothes us with warmth. These are the unchanging facts that ever carry their suggestions to our minds. And therefore, we feel it is India's mission to realize the truth of the human soul in the Supreme Soul through its union with the soul of the world. This mission had taken its natural form in the forest schools in the ancient time. And it still urges us to seek for the vision of the infinite in all forms of creation, in the human relationships of love, to feel it in the air we breathe, in the light in which we open our eyes, in the water in which we bathe, in the earth on which we live and die. Therefore I know, and I know it from my own experience, that the students and the teachers who have come together in this ashram are daily growing towards the emancipation of their mind, into the consciousness of the infinite. Not through any process of teaching or outer discipline, but by the help of an unseen atmosphere of aspiration that surrounds the place and the memory of a devoted soul who lived here in intimate communion with God. I hope I have been able to explain how the conscious purpose that led me to found my school in the ashram gradually lost its independence and grew into unity with the purpose that reigns in this place. In a word, my work found its soul in the spirit of the ashram. But that soul has its outer form, no doubt, which is its aspect of the school. And in the teaching system of this school, I have been trying all these years to carry out my theory of education based upon my experience of children's minds. I believe, as I suggested before, that children have their subconscious mind more active than their conscious intelligence. A vast quantity of the most important of our lessons has been taught to us through this. Experiences of countless generations have been instilled into our nature by its agency, not only without causing us any fatigue, but giving us joy. This subconscious faculty of knowledge is completely one with our life. It is not like a lantern that can be lighted and trimmed from outside. But it is like the light that the glowworm possesses by the exercise of its life processes. Fortunately for me, I was brought up in a family where literature, music, and art had become instinctive. My brothers and cousins lived in the freedom of ideas, and most of them had natural artistic powers. Nourished in these surroundings, I began to think early and to dream, and to put my thoughts into expression. In religion and social ideals, our family was free from all convention, being ostracized by society owing to our secession from orthodox beliefs and customs. This made us fearless in our freedom of mind, and we tried experiments in all departments of life. This was the education I had in my early days, freedom and joy in the exercise of my mental and artistic faculties. And because this made my mind fully alive to grow in its natural environment of nutrition, therefore the grinding of the school system became so extremely intolerable to me. I had only this experience of my early life to help me when I started my school. I felt sure that what was most necessary was the breadth of culture and no formal method of teaching. Fortunately for me, Satish Chandra Roy, a young student of great promise, who was getting ready for his BA degree, became attached to my school and devoted his life to carry out my idea. He was barely 19, but he had a wonderful soul, living in a world of ideas, keenly responsive to all that was beautiful and great in the realm of nature and of human mind. He was a poet who would surely have taken his place among the immortals of world literature if he had been spared to live. But he died when he was 20, thus offering his service to our school only for the period of one short year. With him, boys never felt that they were confined in the limit of a teaching class. They seemed to have their access to everywhere. They would go with him to the forest when in the spring the sal trees were in full blossom, and he would recite to them his favorite poems, frenzied with excitement. He used to read to them Shakespeare and even Browning, for he was a great lover of Browning, explaining to them in Bengali with his wonderful power of expression. He never had any feeling of distrust for boys' capacity of understanding. He would talk and read to them about whatever was the subject in which he himself was interested. He knew that it was not at all necessary for the boys to understand literally and accurately, but that their minds should be roused, and in this he was always successful. He was not like other teachers, a mere vehicle of textbooks. He made his teaching personal. He himself was the source of it, and therefore it was made of life stuff, easily assimilable by the living human nature. The real reason of his success was his intense interest in life, in ideas, in everything around him, in the boys who came in contact with him. He had his inspiration not through the medium of books, but through the direct communication of his sensitive mind with the world. The seasons had upon him the same effect as they had upon the plants. He seemed to feel in his blood the unseen messages of nature that are always traveling through space, floating in the air, shimmering in the sky, tingling in the roots of the grass under the earth. The literature that he studied had not the least smell of the library about it. He had the power to see ideas before him, as he could see his friends, with all the distinctness of form and subtlety of life. Thus, the boys of our school were fortunate enough to be able to receive their lessons from a living teacher and not from textbooks. Have not our books, like most of our necessaries, come between us and our world? We have got into the habit of covering the windows of our minds with their pages, and plasters of book phrases have stuck into our mental skin, making it impervious to all direct touches of truth. A whole world of bookish truths have formed themselves into a strong citadel with rings of walls in which we have taken shelter, secured from the communication of God's creation. Of course, It would be foolish to underrate the advantages of the book. But at the same time, we must admit that the book has its limitations and its dangers. At any rate, during the early period of education, children should come to their lesson of truths through natural processes, directly through persons and things. Being convinced of this, I have set all my resources to create an atmosphere of ideas in the ashram. Songs are composed, not specially made to order for juvenile minds. They are songs that a poet writes for his own pleasure. In fact, most of my Gitanjali songs were written here. These, when fresh in their first bloom, are sung to the boys, and they come in crowds to learn them. They sing them in their leisure hours, sitting in groups, under the open sky on moonlight nights, in the shadows of the impending rain in July. All my latter-day plays have been written here, and the boys have taken part in their performance. Lyrical dramas have been written for their season festivals. They have ready access to the room where I read to the teachers any new things that I write in prose or in verse, whatever the subject may be. And this they utilize without the least pressure put upon them, feeling aggrieved when not invited. A few weeks before leaving India, I read to them Browning's drama Luna, translating it into Bengali as I went on. It took me 2 evenings, but the second meeting was as full as the first one. Those who have witnessed these boys playing their parts in dramatic performances have been struck with their wonderful power as actors. It is because they are never directly trained in the histrionic art. They instinctively enter into the spirit of the plays in which they take part. Though these plays are no mere schoolboy dramas, they require subtle understanding and sympathy. With all the anxiety and hypercritical sensitiveness of an author about the performance of his own play, I have never been disappointed in my boys, and I have rarely allowed teachers to interfere with the boys' own representation of the characters. Very often, they themselves write plays or improvise them, and we are invited to their performance. They hold meetings of their literary clubs, and they have at least 3 illustrated magazines conducted by 3 sections of the school, the most interesting of them being that of the infant section. A number of our boys have shown remarkable powers in drawing and painting, developed not through the orthodox method of copying models, but by following their own bent, and by the help of occasional visits from some artists to inspire the boys with their own work. When I first started my school, my boys had no evident love for music. The consequence is that at the beginning I did not employ a music teacher and did not force the boys to take music lessons. I merely created opportunities when those of us who had the gift could exercise their musical culture. It had the effect of unconsciously training the ears of the boys. And when gradually most of them showed a strong inclination and love for music, I saw that they would be willing to subject themselves to formal teaching, and it was then that I secured a music teacher. In our school, the boys rise very early in the morning, sometimes before it is light. They attend to the drawing of water for their bath. They make up their beds. They do all those things that tend to cultivate the spirit of self-help. I believe in the hour of meditation, and I set aside 15 minutes in the morning and 15 minutes in the evening for that purpose. I insist on this period of meditation, not, however, expecting the boys to be hypocrites and to make believe they are meditating. But I do insist that they remain quiet, that they exert the power of self-control, even though instead of contemplating on God, they may be watching the squirrels running up the trees. Any description of such a school is necessarily inadequate, for the most important element of it is the atmosphere, and the fact that it is not a school which is imposed upon the boys by autocratic authorities. I always try to impress upon their minds that it is their own world, upon which their life ought fully and freely to react. In the school administration, they have their place, and in the matter of punishment, we mostly rely upon their own court of justice. In conclusion, I warn my hearers not to carry away with them any false or exaggerated picture of this ashram. When ideas are stated in a paper, they appear too simple and complete. But in reality, their manifestation through the materials that are living and varied and ever-changing is not so clear and perfect. We have obstacles in human nature and in outer circumstances. Some of us have a feeble faith in boys' minds as living organisms, and some have the natural propensity of doing good by force. On the other hand, the boys have their different degrees of receptivity, and there are a good number of inevitable failures. Delinquencies make their appearance unexpectedly, making us suspicious as to the efficacy of our own ideals. We pass through dark periods of doubt and reaction. But these conflicts and waverings belong to the true aspects of reality. Living ideals can never be set into a clockwork arrangement, giving accurate account of its every second. And those who have firm faith in their idea have to test its truth in discords and failures that are sure to come to tempt them from their path. I, for my part, believe in the principle of life, in the soul of man, more than in methods. I believe that the object of education is the freedom of mind, which can only be achieved through the path of freedom, though freedom has its risk and responsibility as life itself has. I know it for certain, though most people seem to have forgotten it, that children are living beings, more living than grown-up people, who have built their shells of habit around them. Therefore, it is absolutely necessary for their mental health and development that they should not have mere schools for their lessons, but a world whose guiding spirit is personal love. It must be an ashram where men have gathered for the highest end of life, in the peace of nature, where life is not merely meditative, but fully awake in its activities, where boys' minds are not being perpetually drilled into believing that the ideal of the self-idolatry of the nation is the truest ideal for them to accept, where they are bidden to realize man's world as God's kingdom, to whose citizenship they have to aspire, where the sunrise and sunset and the silent glory of stars are not daily ignored, where nature's festivities of flowers and fruit have their joyous recognition from man, and where the young and the old, the teacher and the student, sit at the same table to partake of their daily food and the food of their eternal life. Didn't fall asleep? If that was your goal, you can try another episode. If you want to hear more of Tagore's enlightening lectures, I'll put links in the episode description for the audiobook and print editions. Did I tell you I appreciate you being here? If the feeling's mutual, could you follow, subscribe, or rate with 5 stars? Have a fantastic week. Tune in next time.